Now we take a look at the top stories of the week in national politics. Senators are delaying the confirmation process for President Trump's pick to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. That'll be our lead story today. Ginger Gibson is with us this week, correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
So Ronnie Jackson, Admiral, President Trump's nominee to run the Department of Veterans Affairs, getting scrutiny from lawmakers, issues being raised apparently over his past as a member of the White House medical staff. What are some of the things that we're hearing, some of the things we know, and then people are speculating about at this point?
Well, the one thing we know for certain is that the White House did not really do much vetting of Ronnie Jackson before he was named to be the next VA secretary. It was a lot of surprise for a lot of folks in Washington when he was picked, given that he's, like, never run an organization as large as the VA or even anything close to as large as the VA. And now sort of the byproduct of not vetting your nominees is coming up as a consequence, which is that we've learned that there are accusations that have been made against Jackson for years and in previous years that he was causing a hostile work environment, that he got inebriated on a work trip at one point and knocked on the door of a hotel room of a female colleague, that he was drinking on the job, and that he had some other management problems that are real issues for someone who was going to run an organization that big.
Now, Democrats are raising this as an issue. I understand Republicans in the Senate, regardless of how they feel about whether they want to vote for this nomination, some of them are a bit miffed at the lack of communication from the White House. Is that right?
That's right. This nomination came as a total surprise for even Republican members of Congress. There's an argument to be made that President Trump is trying to think outside the box, that he's trying to appoint someone who's got a different resume, that the last several traditional nominees just didn't work and that agency is a mess. And it's a good idea to get someone with a different pedigree and background. But normally you would go to the important members of the Senate and tell them that you are doing this, give them your justification, and then help them make the argument for you in the Senate. And they're not doing that. They're not giving those senators the kind of help that they expect to be able to make this argument in Jackson's favor to the American people.
Now, President Trump was asked about Jackson's nomination as the head of the VA at the White House yesterday. Here's part of what he had to say.
If I were him, actually, in many ways, I'd love to be him. But the fact is, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. What does he need it for? To be abused by a bunch of politicians that aren't thinking nicely about our country? I really don't think personally he should do it, but it's totally his. I would stand behind him, totally his decision.
And the White House is standing behind him, at least in comments by White House staff since then. But that's kind of a weird statement from the president.
It is. It sort of seemed like he was giving him an escape hatch, suggesting that if Jackson decided to withdraw his nomination, he would be okay with that decision. It is clear in this setting that it appears that the president isn't that gung-ho, but that he's equating it to this sort of mean partisan tactics instead of actual problems with Jackson as a nominee. So in some ways, it could also be read as a defense of his pick.
Is there a timeline now? I know a hearing had been delayed. Do we know when this is going to pick up?
We're still waiting, unless I missed something in the last hour or two, on when exactly we can expect a vote to go forward. I mean, that's a sign that there are negotiations and discussions within the Senate, that they're trying to sort through how and when to decide to move forward. And we know that there's other things happening in the Senate. This is not their only responsibility. They're also having to deal with Pruitt hearings this week. And with a number of other issues, so added to the list of undetermineds by Congress.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters, looking at some of the week's national political news, and that Scott Pruitt hearing is on our list. We'll talk about that coming up in just a few moments here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at some of the top political news of the week with Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters. Ginger, you mentioned Scott Pruitt, EPA head, coming before the Senate this week, I think. What is on the agenda as he talks to members of Congress?
This may prove to be one of the most explosive hearings this month or in the coming weeks in Congress. Pruitt, the head of the EPA, is under siege. He's been engulfed in a number of scandals. We found out that he had installed this very expensive soundproof booth in his office that auditors and the agency said was not an acceptable use of government money. He was living in a condo owned by a lobbyist. He was paying only about $50 a night, which, let me tell you, in Washington, D.C., I don't know where you could get for $50 a night, but it wouldn't be nice. And then had to sort of be booted out after he overstayed his welcome. A lot of questions surrounding the EPA chief, and I think he's going to get a grilling from members of Congress at both sides of the political aisle. Expect to hear both Republicans and Democrats asking really hard questions as he heads to both chambers to testify.
Technically, you're supposed to be talking about the budgets or budgetary issues, but you think these ethical concerns are going to get raised?
Absolutely. Budget hearings are really just an ability for Congress to conduct oversight. They don't have to stick to monetary issues. They can ask these cabinet secretaries as they come in to discuss their budgets anything they would like, and they do. It really are designed to have an annual opportunity for Congress to grill these cabinet secretaries on policy, on issues. These are the kind of hearings, and the EPA is a great example, where sometimes you'll hear a question about national overarching sweeping policy issues, and then the next senator might ask about a single small project in their state or their district. And for that reason, these can be really wide-ranging. But when a member's under so much scrutiny and there's a sort of the cloud of scandal around them, they almost overwhelmingly are engulfed with those topics.
And I want to check in on another reason the EPA is in the news: new rules on how they use scientific studies. And this has been controversial. What is changing?
The EPA has taken a lot of heat about their criticism, or their sort of attempts to get sort of the rank and file and the bureaucratic employees to reassess the way they're using scientific research. They've said that not all science has been created the same, and that they want different levels of scrutiny and they want different levels of assessments on these studies. And this is really sort of feeding two different arguments that we see. We see the right arguing that academics and that universities are sort of distorting scientific results to perpetuate political ideas. And then we see the left arguing that the right is discrediting solid scientific research in order to perpetuate their political ideas. And this is another example of that being at the heart of that debate.
And I want to turn to some election news, a special election in Arizona, their 8th congressional district there for U.S. House seat. It was a Republican-dominated district. The Republicans won, but I understand it's kind of a good news, bad news story for Republicans. Can you talk us through that?
It is a bit of a good news, bad news situation. Republicans did win the seat. Donald Trump won that district in 2016 by 21 points. Trent Franks, the Republican who held that seat before, didn't even have a Democratic challenger the last time he won, and won by more than 30 points. This is red, about as red a district as you could ask for. But it wasn't an easy waltz to victory that it should have been. The Republican Party had to spend millions of dollars helping the candidate there. The Democrats, not believing that they could win the seat, spent almost nothing or very little compared to what the Republicans had spent. And still, the Democrat outperformed in the district than we expected. She lost by about 5 points. So if you do just simple math, a district that Donald Trump won by 20 points, this Republican can now only win it by 5 points. That's a 15-point swing in the district, and not a good sign for Republicans going in to the November elections. If districts swing just 10 points or even 5 points from the last election, that's going to be big pickups for Democrats and a chance that they could take both the House and the Senate.
We'll leave it there for now. Ginger, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, correspondent for Reuters. She was with us for our weekly look at some of the biggest news out of Washington. In a recent article for WisContext, our next guest fact-checked a state lawmaker's claim about rural school funding in the last state budget. The reporting led her to the Kickapoo School District, where there's only 3 students for every square mile. Nina Bertelsen is a student journalist and news manager at the Daily Cardinal, a student newspaper at UW-Madison. She's with us now to talk about that piece. Nina, thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, this look at a particular school district, it started off as a fact check, right, about a claim about school funding made by a state senator. So what was that claim? How did you dig into it?
Yeah, so State Senator Janet Buley from Ashland claimed that sparsity aid funding from the proposal in the state budget to what was actually signed to the state budget was cut by about two-thirds. And then the plan to make up for it, which was Senate and Assembly bill set that was signed into law, only made up for part of it. So kind of diving into that, we found that that was mostly true. It was a little bit off in her estimate, but that was mostly true. And so then I decided to follow up and try to get in contact with a small school district to see what sparsity aid impact actually has for them.
And that took you to the Kickapoo School District. Can you talk about some of the budget challenges that you found there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So Kickapoo was one of the few that actually called me back, so I was very grateful for that. So their superintendent was wonderful and spoke to me about some of their challenges, different from larger school districts that have more students. They can kind of consolidate their costs, have more kids in classrooms, and give more options. They have to kind of get creative and make choices, is how he explained it. So they combine their school psychologist with their special education coordinator, which is something that he mentioned and is in the article, and they some of their extracurricular or elective classes, they don't have as many, they can't offer as many, or they combine them. So they have an agricultural food processing class, but they don't have kind of a family consumer science class. And so in that class, they learn how to do roasts and make kind of ice cream, and they kind of combine them that way. And so it was really, for them, about choices, but being able to still provide a high level of education for their students is something that he really emphasized.
Right. That seemed like a theme that kept coming back, the idea that, okay, we do have to make these tough choices, but we don't want to let kids down. We don't want them to have an inferior educational experience.
Yeah, definitely. And that the student that I talked to as well, Hannah, mentioned that, you know, there were benefits to small school districts because it's so small. You get to have kind of deeper relationships with teachers and classmates because your classes are so small. But, you know, that does mean that maybe you don't have some of the same offerings as other schools. So she mentioned that, you know, if she had wanted to go into STEM, she might not have had as many math, kind of higher math offerings in high school that some of her kids or some of her friends that came from larger school districts had when they came to Madison. So, you know, trade-offs.
Another challenge we hear sometimes from smaller school districts who need this, who rely on the sparsity aid, is that they have trouble attracting teachers. They can't pay as much as a bigger district. They might not be able to offer as many amenities for a teacher who might want to move to a bigger community. Was that something you found in the Kickapoo School District, too?
Yeah, that's something that their superintendent mentioned, but something that he also emphasized was that it's about finding the right fit. And so a lot of their teachers have been around for a long time and are really invested in the community. And that it's, you know, if they have a teacher that comes in that, you know, doesn't really want to stick around in a rural school district for a long time, that maybe that isn't the best fit. And so he mentioned that they've been really lucky to have teachers that have stuck around for a long time, and they have really been able to find the right fit where the teachers want to be in their school district, and that even though it's smaller, and they really want them because they're able to provide an education. So kind of about finding matches was how they balanced that, he really emphasized.
Bringing it back full circle, you started off looking at sparsity aid for school districts. Did people at the Kickapoo District talk about how important that sparsity aid is in their efforts to do all the stuff we just talked about?
Yeah, so, you know, the superintendent, Doug Olson, definitely mentioned that, you know, it was a welcome benefit, and it helps them do different things around their schools, whether it helps them provide a more competitive pay and benefits package to their teachers, or it helps them. Some school districts will use it for building repairs, that it is something that, you know, they do use, and it does help them stay more competitive, was something that he said.
Nina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Nina Bertelsen, student journalist and news manager at UW-Madison's newspaper, The Daily Cardinal. Mike Wagner joins us now to talk about the student fact-check program that's published online at the Observatory. Mike's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Observatory was the origin point for Nina's story there. Tell us about why you're getting students involved in this fact-checking exercise.
Right. So the Observatory is a Baldwin, Wisconsin idea grant-funded project that was hatched by me and my colleague Lucas Graves. And we have seen, and Lucas's research is about fact-checking in journalism, and we have seen this growth in fact-checking and less so at the local level. And we thought, you know, with these kind of the decreasing size of newsrooms in covering state government and state politics, there really should be a group of journalists dedicated to fact-checking things that our politicians say and other political elites say. And so we got this grant and started this website, the observatory.journalism.wisc.edu. And we teach it as a class where students learn how to do fact-check journalism. They are assigned lawmakers. We assign an equal number of Republicans and Democrats to students. They fact-check claims that they make in the public domain. They rate them based on what we call the Veritas scale, which is Latin for truth. And after the students do their work and they get feedback from me, then they go through the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism's fact-checking process with their managing editor, Dee Hall, because the last thing we want to do on a fact-checking site is get a fact wrong. And so we go through a kind of a two-stage process before we put anything up on the web.
How do you pick an accessible fact? I mean, because there could be sort of generic claims like Wisconsin is the best it's ever been or the worst it's ever been. You need a verifiable claim, right?
Exactly. And this is a huge controversy in the fact-checking world, which is why it's been so great to work with Lucas Graves, who's one of the experts on planet Earth about this stuff. Some places like PolitiFact will say we're going to only take claims that are absolutely checkable. You know, our economy grew by 3% since I became governor. Stuff like that, where you can say, well, okay, when did the person become governor? How did the economy grow? Let's weigh in on whether that's true. Other kinds of claims are murkier. They're more specific than Wisconsin's the greatest state in the country, right? There are things like one we recently did where the governor called small businesses, like one in particular that he was talking about, the backbone of the economy because they provide family wages. And so those aren't precise claims, but there's still things we can try to check. And so we had a student fact check that claim, talked to a lot of experts about, well, what does it mean to be the backbone of an economy? What percentage do small businesses contribute to the state economy? And what are the wages that those people who work in those small businesses earn? And so most fact-checking organizations will either rate claims on some truth scale or just provide a story. We'll rate them or we'll call them unobservable, which is to say, here's what we can tell you about it, but we can't tell you precisely whether it's true or false because the claim was too vague.
It seems like one common theme in your fact-checking with the students and any fact-checking operation is, you know, the words we dreaded to hear from the high school math teacher, show your work. And,
right.
And so there is the explanation of how you assess the claims, not just the ultimate rating.
Right. We take the reader through, here's every part of the claim we're checking. Here's every piece of data or interview we use to get that. We provide hyperlinks to everything for which there's a document for. We list the interviews and the people we talk to at the bottom of every story. So anything that we used to weigh in on the veracity of a claim, the reader could do themselves, or at least could retrace our steps.
If you fact check my claim and I don't like, and you said, what, Rob? No, you were way off there. Do I get to weigh in? Do I get to say, here's what I meant, here's why I think I'm right?
Yes. Our step one is contact the person who made the claim and ask, what did you mean by that? And where did you get the information you used to make that claim? Sometimes people get back to us. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they get back to us well into the process and say, oh, what I really meant is something that maybe sounds a little bit self-serving. But we tend to take people at their word and say, if that's what you meant, we'll try to check that. But we'll also tell a more contextual story about what other people might have interpreted that claim to mean and whether those interpretations are true as well.
We've talked to your colleague Lucas Graves on the show about this rise of fact-checking. Why fact-checking? Why now? Why has this become such a big thing all of a sudden?
Well, part of it is just the media ecology that we live in, where people can choose for themselves to listen, read, watch places that just tell them that their side is right and the other side is wrong. And we need sources that don't have an ideological stake in the game to say, we have done an investigation to see whether this claim is true or this claim is false. And knowing whether our leaders are saying things that are true or false, or only true under some circumstances or only false under some circumstances, are important for us to know as we make our decisions about whether we want to rehire these people on Election Day.
Does fact-checking inform other kinds of reporting now?
I think it does. There's a little bit of evidence that politicians who get fact-checked become a little bit more careful in how they speak publicly about things, having been through that process, and especially if the result is it was not a good one for them. There's some evidence that fact-checking can help individuals understand what's true. There's also evidence that people read fact checks and double down on their own partisan beliefs regardless of what the fact check says, or will attack the fact checkers themselves. And there's a lot of folks who attack different organizations out there by saying they're ideologically motivated in one way or another.
Fact checking is potentially very time consuming, yep. Labor intensive from a journalism perspective.
It is.
Newsrooms, in many cases, are smaller now than they used to be, getting smaller in many cases. Is this sustainable?
It's difficult. Usually what the local outfits have done have been like ours, which is grant-funded, or something like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel does, where they partner with PolitiFact, and maybe there's one or two people who are dedicated to doing the fact-checking, while their other journalists do the things that journalists do, cover the State House, cover the arts, cover education, all those sorts of things.
Is fact-checking now a key part of any up-and-coming journalist education?
I think it is. It's a place where jobs are growing. We place a lot of students in organizations like PolitiFact and other fact-checking outfits around the country, and it's something that readers like. It's something that journalists themselves, and that Lucas has shown in his own research, journalists believe it's prestigious and worth doing. It's something that audiences look for, which is good in the media models we find ourselves in economically right now. And so I think it's here to stay.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about the student fact check program there called The Observatory.